Blog Talk Radio. Awakenings. Welcome all in the chat, and welcome those that are listening via Cosmic Dimensions right now. We're streaming live there as well. And those of you that are joining us later in the archives or iTunes, good to connect with all of you. That little bit of music was a bit of Sea of Glass in the beginning. So happy Wednesday, everyone. Happy, wonderful Wednesday. Tell you all or a little bit about Awakenings, those of you that perhaps are tuning in for the first time. Awakenings is a live internet radio program that focuses on the grounding of the spiritual process of awakening. You can join us and our guests as we explore life in the higher realms. Awakenings tracks the succession and changes of awakenings. Awakenings is also a place where science and spirituality are bridged together. It's part of the converging flow where people are coming from all walks of life and waking up and taking this awakened state into their everyday lives. And I'm sure you are seeing more and more people are doing this. Just to let you know, if you're new, if you have questions in the chat and you're in the chat, we have a wonderful bunch of beings in the chat, a lively crew. It's been renamed the Sacred Space of Empowerment, so that kind of gives you a heads up. But you know, if you're new to Awakenings, just know also there's a lot of amazing inside information, connectings, collaborations that are going on, and you can find out about that in the chat room. Just say hi. If you're a guest, you can listen, but if you want to participate with questions, you actually either have to call in or do a quick registration, and then you can post questions in the chat and dialogue if you choose. Or some of you want to be stealth, kind of under the radar, on the down low, you may not, you know, just sign in as a guest, that's fine. I do that a lot with shows, too, because sometimes it's a hassle to sign in. I just, you know, surf around and then listen as a guest. So, but if you do have questions, call in, and the number is 347-539-5122. That's 347-539-5122. And if you hit the number 1 on your keypad of the phone, it'll give me an alert on the switchboard that you have a question. Because I do get people just calling in to listen while they're driving around, or I hear some people working out, so they're listening on the phone, you know, or later on their iPod. But however you're getting your daily dose of awakenings to keep in that converging flow and keep awake is great. I appreciate all of you that have been listening and calling in with, you know, questions and feedback, and those in the chat that are giving feedback as well. It's just great to connect with all of you and kind of share this individual and collective shift that's going on and has been going on, but is getting more and more noticeable to many people. Also, I wanted to share with you, because I've gotten some emails about, and are we on Facebook? Yes, at Awakenings Radio. So share your insight. You know, some people, you may want to just connect with someone or know what's going on in your area, so you can definitely sign up there and leave your connecting details, contact info, and that will help others connect with you as well another way. Okay, we have a great question already in the chat. I think it's from Debbie. Oh, yeah, if we're talking about premonitions, I would like to understand why some are spot on and others seem to be way off base. I trust my intuition, but I've had some insights that have not happened. There's a few things there. One thing I tell people in people that do intuitive development programs with me, you have to clear emotionally. You have to have a way to find out if something is your wishful thinking, or, you know, is it coming through in a metaphor? Is it a feeling? You know, because sometimes you can get an intuitive wisdom or body, an instinctual wisdom, like what we call it, kinesthetic, coming from the feeling, like a gut knowing. But there's also, that's also the place of fear. And fear has its place. It may say not right now, or you're stretching boundaries, or maybe you're learning something new. So it, a lot of things sometimes with the intuition is really the interpretation. And that's such a great question, Debbie, because I think that's the biggest thing that I see is for people to get clear, to get accurate, and then to trust their accuracy. The other thing is that there is a destiny, a blueprint. So there is a template. So there's some things that are what we call destiny issues, fated. But timing can be off. Timing can be different. So there's things that we can forestall or delay, or there are things that we can don't have to do. There's things that we have free will choice. So in a way, our enlightenment or empowerment, you know, being able to really see, comes from knowing the difference. Is this something that I need to do, and then do I begrudgingly do it? But yeah, it's there's really no set. There's parameters, but there's no set if it looks this way or feels this way, because sometimes you have to let it play out and just be in that witness state or that meditative state to see how is this unfolding, and then watch. Because we're, you know, as human beings, we're amazing co-creators, and we can co-create from the lower harmonic of simply the ego personality, or we can co-create from the more expanded consciousness or higher harmonic of the higher self or the psyche, the soul, coming from the psychic impression. But it still comes from a filter, you know, it's still coming through the human. So a lot of times people, you know, it's colored by too colored by their experiences or their expectations. Let's see. Okay, Lyda is mentioning that she had been going. She felt she was going to die in a car accident on a specific trip. I didn't want this to happen, and it didn't, but I was convinced. Well, that's an interesting one, because I actually had something similar around the 9/11 time, and some of you have heard me mention it, that I love traveling. You know, my past incarnation, if you will, with my career, I did a lot of traveling, and I love getting on the plane. I love turbulence even. So I was supposed to be traveling right around the time of the 9/11 situation, and 2 weeks before I started having really bizarre dreams and nightmares. I mean, literally of being blown up and pulled out of a plane, and just the one side of the plane just, you know, blowing up. What else could I say? And I was about to book my tickets, because you want to book out a little bit further, right, to get that better price. And I told a couple friends of mine, and everyone said it was stress. Oh, Michelle, you're so busy, things are going on, it's stress, or maybe you're afraid of flying. And I said, I love flying. And I love roller coasters. So I was like, I don't know what, but I was definitely waking up feeling not just fear, but terror. I mean, I was enough for me to tell people about it and know it's not just a little nightmare. And I was a little, I'll be honest, I was a little wigged out. I was like, oh, maybe I shouldn't be taking this trip, you know. So, and I sat with it a little bit, and I thought, okay, there is something coming through. And again, this is where I'm saying you have to get in that space of meditative clearness to know, am I stressed out? Is this an anxiety response? You know, is this like stage fright? You know, somebody could say you have terrible, you know, people could have night tremors before giving a speaking engagement. You know, so you have, that's where our enlightenment, our awareness comes in. Is it some new area that I'm coming into and I'm afraid of that? Or is it some other message? And when I sat with it, I got the message, this is not the time to fly. And then, of course, shortly after that, I remember being awakened early in the morning, probably around 6:37, by some friends calling. And we know the rest is history. So I feel you have to know yourself to know. I've had other premonitions that have come through in a dream that have actually come true, to have come to fruition, Or sometimes we'll get visions. I've recently had a vision that's coming to pass as far as in an internet project, and actually what person to take it to, and that all came to pass. So I know it might seem like I'm being evasive, or it's a long answer to a short question, but I want to say you begin to really know you and how you interpret your messages. And Lida is saying, is that from your inner knowing or from my spirit guides? No, my inner knowing. A lot of times what I have found, the premonitions come from the inner knowing. Or they'll come through, you know, either a dream, a flash of insight, a vision, sometimes hearing. My sense, it doesn't have to come from guides, and usually does not. I mean, the project actually did come from the spiritual hierarchy and the oversoul. So that part, yeah, they, on that one. But the other ones was simply just a revealing. So, again, you know, it's that wonderful saying that's over the mystic school of Delphi, know thyself. You have to know. And if I don't know, I'll wait for confirmation. I'll wait and I'll feel it out. And one thing that I suggest to people is to fall. If you get in that meditative state, if you get centered, and you have, and this is the other thing though. Here's a little caveat. Our expectations can sway us, or if we really don't want to know the answer. That's why muscle testing is great. Kinesiology is great. However, the mind can sway the results. So again, you have to be in that clear meditative state to know, you know, how am I getting this information, and is this information accurate? Or kind of wait and see, let it unfold a little bit. But we all have this gift within us. It's just, how do we refine it? It's like, you know, somebody that is a great musician or artist or pianist or whatever, a great, you know, potterer, you still have to hone things and refine things. And so we always have that little bit of, you know, inner work or application. Today, I really feel honored to have on the program Dr. Larry Dossey. And I first found out about his work from Recovering the Soul, amazing, amazing book. You've got to have that on your in your library. I've reread it, and I've used it countless times. I can't tell you as for research or to suggest to clients, coming from being a healer, he was really one of the people in the forefront of bridging the scientific and spiritual research. So what many of us knew as healers or, you know, psychic channels or mediums, he really took that and codified that and put that together and kind of proved, you know, the power of intention, the power of prayer, the power of thought, the power that we have a healing, that we are connected to this energy, we are that energy, and that we can use that for good, or allow ourselves to be a channel for good. So Larry Dossey really is in the forefront of bridging science and spirituality, comes from a background in medicine, completely in the medical establishment, and was very focused in that for quite a long time. In his own words, Larry Dossey says, I used to believe that we must choose between science and hand and spirituality in how we lead our lives. This is a false choice. We can recover the sense of sacredness, science, but in perhaps an everyday life. And that was from his book, Reinventing Medicine. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Larry Dossey to Awakenings.
Hi, Michelle.
Hello, Dr. Dossey. Hi. What an honor. I'm tickled. I'm like a little starstruck.
Well, I'm tickled, too. It's great to be with you.
Oh, gosh.
Tickled
you
is the
really
word we don't use enough.
I know. I love it. You know, I have it on my cell phone. Are you following your divine tickle?
Oh, that's great.
But I want to share with people, because obviously a lot of the listeners have heard of you before and have read your books, but you've got, let's see, Recovering the Soul, that one I still keep going back to, Meaning in Medicine, you've got Space, Time, and Medicine, also Healing Words, The Power of Prayer and the Practice of Medicine, Prayer is Good, How to Reap the Healing Benefits of Prayer, and of course your latest, The Power of Premonition. you really, more than any other, and I really want to find out why, how this turning point happened for you, because you really delved into that whole idea of prayer, focused prayer, if there's an actual specific to it, or is it just an energy or holding that prayerful space, you know, connecting in energetically. You really got in there and did a lot of research in the power of prayer and healing and the whole idea of the healing as an energy field. What prompted this?
Well, that's a great question, and I continue to ask that question of myself. I think some things happen to us in life that are not altogether conscious choices. I remember reading a biography of the great artist, the modern artist Paul Klee, once, who was asked, why did you use all of this color in your impressionistic art? And he said three words. He said, "Color got me." And in other words, there are forces out there that, if we remain open and let ourselves be moved by them, can influence us in one direction or another. I think my own directions in connecting spirituality and healthcare were simply that sort of thing. I tried to be open to the evidence and for what worked, and to be open to my experiences with patients. And this is just simply the direction that I was moved in. I sometimes think this topic did me, you know. I didn't do it except to remain open to the possibility. And I think that's really key in how we see these things. I'm a sort of an incorrigible introvert, you know, and I have trouble telling the universe how to behave and how to get on. And I try to be open to what it wants to say. I try to be open to a wisdom greater and higher than my own. And this is just sort of where I've wound up. I simply try to order my life where I put one foot in front of the other. And, you know, just as Joseph Campbell said once, to follow one's bliss. So that's how it works for me.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you have this approach, attitude and understanding when you were practicing medicine?
Well, I certainly
did. Let's
say
conventional medicine, because I think you're still practicing medicine, but it's in a different way, right? It's still healing.
Yeah, it's healing. It's taken a different form. I no longer see patients or have hospital duties and that sort of thing, but I think I reach more people now than I ever did when I was seeing patients one-on-one in my medical practice. I really do not remember not being interested in the role of consciousness and spirituality and healing. It just seemed to be in my mother's milk, as they say. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed the natural way to go. And certainly as I began to look around, looking as a scientifically oriented physician for evidence that spirituality and consciousness mattered, I'm telling you, it's all over the place.
Wow.
You know, we have a selective blindness as we go through our medical education that teaches us how to ignore this sort of thing. And when we see it, to say that it's just, you know, new age woo-woo stuff and it's not scientific and that sort of thing, that just simply is not true. And I've tried to bring attention to this this role of consciousness and spirituality and to say, look, if we're going to call this stuff scientific medicine, we're going to have to include this in it. And it's been my task over the years to do exactly that and to show people why this is good medicine, even from a strictly scientific point of view.
Wow. So now you're saying when you saw this all the time, so you're saying that the blinders are taught or something, that because you were seeing this spirituality and this interconnection even as you were going to school and even as you were practicing medicine, you saw this?
Oh, absolutely. I remember, for example, you know, you mentioned one of my books, Healing Words, The Power of Prayer and the Practice of Medicine. I remember even as a young medical student, I was assigned to an elderly black man who had lung cancer in both lungs, and it was disseminated metastatic breast cancer. The man was dying, and the only treatment he had was that the people from his church congregation came and ringed his bed during all visiting hours and simply sang hymns to this man and prayed. He didn't want any treatment. Back in those days, there wasn't any treatment for lung cancer. He just wanted to go home and die with his family around him. I accommodated that and helped get him discharged and so on. And I was sure that he was going to be dead within a couple of days. Imagine my surprise when a year later he showed back up at the hospital with a bad case of the flu. He was admitted to another doctor, and the doctor said, "Well, you know, you should go by and see your old patient. He wants to see you. He's back with the flu." First thing I did was to go down to the X-ray area and look at his current chest X-ray, and it was normal.
It was normal.
The cancer was gone. The only treatment this guy had, if you want to call it treatment, was prayer. He had nothing else. So that's just an example of, you know, the sort of things that you bump into if you keep your eyes open about the connection between spirituality and getting well.
But see, now it sounds like you were open to that. In other words, that it was okay if it was something else, if something else happened other than, you know, a pill, you know, a surgery or a conventional medical procedure.
Well, I was open to it. I was also curious. You know, the things that lead to great advances in medicine throughout history have been the things that do not fit in, the things that crop up at the edges that are what we call anomalies. That's where the great advances are made. If you go through your life shutting those things out, you never get anywhere. You always stay stuck in the present. There is no advance in medicine. And so I think it's one of the greatest qualities a healer or any kind of scientist can have is just simply curiosity to try to see what doesn't fit in and how we might expand our ideas about how the world works to greater proportions. So I think that's what I've been up to for all these years.
And then it sounds also that this curiosity is also leading you in the direction of spirit.
Well, that's exactly right. I love the term spirit because it's a pretty good term for what can't be described in purely physical terms. For example, the area of what's being called consciousness studies these days shows that there's some quality of our minds that just can't be described in the old language of classical physics, of space and time and energy and this sort of thing. And this is what we see in remote healing, prayer at a distance where there isn't any obvious or demonstrable sort of energy mediating these effects. Also we see this in the topic of this latest book that I've written, Premonitions, The Power of Premonitions, where we understand things before they even happen. We have intuition, we have gut feelings, vibes, and so on, of what's about to happen. There's no way that the old matter, space, time, energy concepts can explain any of that. But there they are. And so we have to go beyond those old terms of understanding how the world works and invoke some of the concept. Spirit is as good as any. I think consciousness is right up there at the top if we understand consciousness in the right way. But the point
I love consciousness.
Well, I do too. The point is to just make an opening for these things. We don't understand totally how they work now, but that's no excuse for not honoring their existence. And so I've tried to really do that.
I like what you say here about make a space for them. Because I think what's happened, you know, and obviously you would know more of this because you're come from the medical field, but it seems like that field, as well as others, have not had a space or an opening for that, not only idea, but that reality, you know, that is even a possibility. So,
well, that's right. And, you know, when I was growing up, my grandmother and grandfather, like many grandparents, used to give my brother and sister and me what they called mad money. You could just spend it on anything you wanted to as a kid. You know, they didn't care. And I think that there ought to be a little space in science for something like mad money, where you open yourself up to all sorts of possibilities. You give yourself permission to even be wrong. You give yourself elbow room to explore new ideas and to take chances in your thinking and your experiments and your observation. That's really an important quality to good science. Because if you try to rein things in and connect everything with what's already known, as I mentioned, you stay stuck and you don't get anywhere.
And is it, you know, to use the consciousness, that's what manifests. So if really we want to go to those innovations or new ideas or healing technologies or that power healing, it in a sense is to go, it's necessary to go with that and beyond the system into the consciousness, into what created the system, right?
Oh, absolutely. you know, I've used the term for several years to explain how this may work with respect to consciousness. And so one of my favorite terms to get a handle on this stuff is the term non-local mind, which I introduced in 1989 in a book called Recovering the Soul.
Yes, the local mind. I loved it. Ah.
Well, thank you. The term non-local mind simply means that consciousness is infinite in space and time. It doesn't go anywhere. It's already there. It isn't stuck in the present. We see this in the science of surrounding premonitions in this latest book. So consciousness is not confined to little points in space, such as our brains or our bodies, and it isn't even confined to spaces and time. It's non-local. It's not localized. It's infinite.
Mm-hmm.
It's everywhere. I think only by honoring this kind of image of consciousness can we explain what we see. So we need different pictures of the mind. We need a picture that allows consciousness to operate beyond the confines of the body in the present moment. That's where all of this is headed. Whatever term we come up with, whether we call it non-local mind or infinite mind, the idea is that space and time are totally irrelevant with the respect to these kinds of operations of consciousness. I found this terribly exciting because once we have an image of how consciousness might operate, then we become more open to what we observe and how people actually get on in the world.
Yeah. Well, I think when you coined that term, and I remember reading it, because I believe I've referred so many people to your book, I'm like, just read this, the non-local mind, that's what you're using. Because people somehow, you know, as human beings, we want to, you know, wrap our mind around something. We want to know how is this working, or where am I going, or is something coming to me, or what's going. You know, infinite is great too, but it's like, you know, it's way out there. But non-local, to me, when people started using that term, gave them permission, like, oh,
yeah,
it's kind of an extended part of me, you know.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah. Gave them some frame of reference to, it's not just right here, right what's in front of me.
Right. And, you know, getting back to the connection between spirit and non-local mind, there really are some really interesting implications here. If you think about it, if there's some part of your mind that really is non-local in time, then that means it's everywhere in time. You can't put it in a box and wall it off. And if it's everywhere in time, then it's immortal. It's eternal. And so it's just really a short step from this idea of non-local mind to the idea of immortality. And I think we ought to not be bashful about these things and shy about talking about the spiritual implications of them. All this stuff about non-local consciousness points like an arrow to the idea of the soul, some immortal, eternal aspect of who we are. So we just might as well suck it up and just say, look, it's time to be bold and full-throated and just tell it like it is. We have something called the soul, some non-local, temporally non-local aspect of who we are. We might as well just sort of say it straight out, you know. There's a soul, there's a non-local aspect of human consciousness that's immortal and eternal in time. So the theological or spiritual implications of you know, what we're talking about are utterly profound.
Well, I like what you say, the suck it up. People, we have to get comfortable with our greatness, right? We have to get that we know that we know, like you in your, you know,
planet
book, The Power of Premonition, that we can know and we can trust that knowing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we do have a question. I want to get to the patient person here on the line. And I'm hoping, let's see. 856-325, you're on Awakenings.
Hi, is this Michelle?
Yes, it is.
Hi,
you're
Michelle.
On Awakening.
Well, I wanted to say hello to both you and your guest, Dr. Dossie.
Hi.
I've been listening to the show, and I think it's absolutely amazing. So kudos to you for having him on as a guest. But
I
marked you as a favorite, so I want you to know that too. But I was recently diagnosed. I was ill. I became ill when I was 37. I started to feel
really
sick.
Can I interrupt 1 second just to get your
sure.
first name? Because you know Dr. Larry Dossie's name. You know my name, Michelle. Let's
I'm sorry. Yeah,
that's
I'm
okay.
Jackie. I'm calling from the Philadelphia area.
Oh, great, Jackie. Okay, great. Go
from
ahead.
Jackie from Philly. Good old Philadelphia. But I was, got really sick when I was about 37. And my father, believe it or not, is a doctor. And I went to him and said, wow, Dad, you know, I'm really feeling bad. I'm tired all the time. I don't understand. I'm really in pain, and my joints hurt. And he just thought, oh, you know, it's probably nothing. Just take Motrin. Just take Tylenol. And there was something within me that really knew after about a couple of months that, you know what, something is really wrong with me. So I ended up going to see another doctor and was diagnosed with lupus, which is not fun. And they put me on something called Cellcept, which is a chemo drug, which it kind of shocked me that they use that for lupus, and then steroids, and then something called Tequin, which is an anti-malarial drug. So this is like the course of medications that they really use for almost all autoimmune diseases. And I read your book, Dr. Dossie, which was Healing Words.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of your books that I did read during this time that all this was happening, which was about 2 years ago. And I stopped kind of all those treatments and really just started to, you know, think positively. I was in so much pain. My pain level was really off the charts. It was unbelievable, and they were giving me, you know, very strong narcotics, and I couldn't function, and it was awful. There's just no way to live your life. And then to be told, well, this is your life from now on, was very depressing. So when I read your book and then I hear about the power of premonitions, you know, I just knew that I had to take my own healing into my own hands, and that there were some things that medicine, conventional medicine, was not going to be able to do for me. And since I stopped treatment and I started, you know, doing vitamins, taking vitamin D, seeing a nutritionist, believe it or not, working with Dr. Barry Sears, who's the Zone Diet doctor, and just changing some of these things, I actually, and through reading your book, I actually have gotten so much better.
Wow.
Well,
inspiring.
That's quite a story, Jackie. Thank you. You know,
so I wanted to thank you for your book.
Well, thank you. I find that it's very difficult to advise people about their illnesses just over the telephone. I know a lot of doctors do that. I'm very cautious about that because I think that all diseases are very individual, and
absolutely,
and a doctor really needs to know quite a lot about the psyche and the consciousness as well as the physical aspects of anyone that he or she talks to in terms of illness.
Mm-hmm.
But I can say this, regardless of how anyone chooses to approach an illness, whether it's to take medications, whatever they may be, or not to do that, it's always advisable, as far as I'm concerned, to bring spirit and consciousness to bear on the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no incompatibility with spirit and consciousness with whatever else you decide to do. You're always better off, I think, if you ally yourself with consciousness-oriented therapies such as prayer, meditation, and imagery, visualization, and so on. So that's my standard response to anyone's illness. You know, do whatever you choose to do along the other lines, but for goodness sakes, honor the evidence that prayer and imagery, visualization, and consciousness-mediated therapies also can be brought to bear on a problem. There are some people whom I know who have had lupus who actually have had dramatic turnarounds when those medications that you mentioned have been used. Others mm-hmm. fail completely. And in between, you know, there's a spectrum of people who respond modestly and so on, or not at all. So it's an individual thing, and
right.
I think it would be arrogant for me to, you know, proclaim that anyone that I've, you know, met over the telephone or the Internet for 5 minutes or so, that I could actually dictate which direction you ought to go, except for the fact that I'm convinced that consciousness-mediated therapies ought to be a part of everybody's therapeutic plan.
Absolutely. And I really want to get the power of premonitions. I think that's going to be, I'm going to click here where she has it. I like that you put it on there so that I can click and I can be taken to the book, because I just really think that's going to be the next thing on my reading list. So,
that'd be great. Yeah, it makes it easy because you start getting inspired. That way you don't have to mucky around. It's right there on the site. Click, and there you go to the books.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for this show, Dr. Dossie, for being a guest. And Michelle, thank you for you know, having this show. And I will definitely be listening.
Jackie, thank you.
Oh, great, Jackie. Thank you
so
much.
Have a great day.
Thanks for sharing. Yeah, thanks for sharing your story and your experience. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye. Yeah, it's so helpful to hear how people manage their conditions, you know.
Well, actually, I'm inspired every time I hear a story like that, and God knows there are a million of them.
Mm-hmm.
And this woman had the courage to follow her own intuitions. You know, the fact that her father was a doctor is interesting. I think that physicians make terrible doctors for members of their own family.
Generally speaking,
too close to things, and you know, you think that they might be the best people to turn to, but it's not always the case because you're so close mm-hmm. to things that you just don't see the forest for the trees often. And this is a dramatic example of that.
Well, I know as a therapist, they say don't, you know, find somebody else. don't be treating your family member.
Exactly.
Of course, when you're going to school, you're treating everybody wishes you were studying something else because you're trying everything on them and you think you know best. You know?
Oh, I know.
You know, one thing I appreciate, too, that you mentioned, Dr. Dossie, and really it ties in with just a little bit of the talk I was doing at the top of the program, was that we're so individual, and I so appreciated that you're, you know, basically saying that as well, that you couldn't just, you know, give some type of diagnosis or, you know, treatment or even advice or suggestion other than the focusing on consciousness or adding that in. And I think so many times people look for, in other words, and I'm not saying anybody listening is doing that, but it's been my experience that somehow we want formulas a lot of times.
Everybody wants a formula, that's right.
Yeah, and it really, what I get from, you know, what you were saying there as well as your books, that it is so individual. What's right for... Really? Okay.
I think that's just a terrific point to emphasize. And, you know, even in a consciousness-oriented therapy such as prayer, when I was researching that book, I devoted significant energy to looking into how people pray. And I found out quite quickly that there is no formula. If you look at people who successfully use prayer in getting well, their ways of doing it are all over the ballpark. I mean, it's almost embarrassing, Michelle, about the variety of the ways people do these things. There are people who actually pray that the disease actually go away and be replaced by normal, healthy tissue and normal biochemical functioning. And they feel comfortable in making their prayers absolutely as specific as possible. There are other people who are repelled by that approach. And they simply ask that, you know, greater wisdom prevail. They don't spell it out. They just simply ask for the best outcome to happen, or thy will be done, or something like that. In other words, they're extremely nonspecific. You can gather cases where the disease responds to both of those things. They seem almost antithetical, completely opposite, but they both work. You can't find a formula for these things. You can't even find a formula that works for everybody in conventional medicine. You know, if you look at something called the physician's desk reference, which is a compilation of all the drugs available in modern medicine, half of the pages of this volume, which goes to several thousand pages, half of that information is devoted to side effects. Some people have them, some don't. So you can't, whether we're talking conventional medicine or consciousness-oriented therapies, it just isn't the case that there's a formula that applies equally to everybody. Everybody's different.
So I wonder where we got that, because there's so, and this ties into your book, because at the top of the hour, people are asking about premonition. And, of course, you know, some people can be very off, you know, depending on their expectation and their filters.
Right.
So, again, we're moving into that realm of how to assist other people to tap into this for themselves.
Yeah.
But you can't necessarily do a cookie cutter. You know, if your stomach flutters twice, that's a yes. If it flutters once, that's a no, you know.
Yeah. No, I know it. You know, I bumped into this problem of individuality also in asking the question, well, you know, how can I know premonitions personally, and how can I invite them into my life? And one thing that you discover, I think, quite quickly is that this stuff is usually so unconscious, it comes from deep within us, that it is not controllable. You cannot manipulate it at your own will. I mean, you can't produce a premonition on cue. What one has to do is to align oneself and engage, as we were talking about earlier, in openness and invite these things to show up in our life. But for goodness sakes, not control or manipulate them. That's the quickest way to send them scurrying away rather than to appear in one's life. So there's a point at which one, as in meditation, simply sits with this possibility of premonitions, invites it into one's life, tries to set the stage for its appearance, and then just simply, as Carl Jung, the psychologist, used to say, get down on your knees and thank the universe for whatever it decides to send you. I think that's the idea here. So it's not the approach of the formula, how you do this. You know, there are no seven easy steps to anything where consciousness is concerned. I think an approach of humility and invitation and openness is the key, particularly where premonitions are concerned.
So it is that being open. And then again, there's the how to, and again, can't be cookie cutter, how to know the signs and then how to trust that, I guess, is a couple other questions I had received by email. How do we know the signs and how do we trust?
Well, let me just say something about the signs. You know, I think the starting point is just simply to acknowledge that some premonitions that come in the form of dreams and even waking visions are just absolutely nutty. I mean, they're fantasy, hallucinations might be a term. They don't turn out to be true. They're wildly inaccurate. So how can you distinguish those from those that you ought to trust and pay attention to?
Yes.
I think there are some really good clues about how to do that. I'm just going to hit some high points here, and people can go to the book for elaborations. But people who have, for example, precognitive or premonition-type dreams that turn out to be true generally agree that these are extremely vivid. There's just something about those dreams that turn out to be true that sets them apart qualitatively from just your average ordinary dream that doesn't turn out to be true. One woman told me that she felt like those kinds of dreams are lit up from the inside. They're just different in terms of drama and vividness. One woman said those kinds of dreams come to her in italics. They're sort of set apart. And time again, and I go into this with many, many examples in the book, these things just sort of knock your socks off. I remember in my own experience with these sort of dreams that turned out to be true during my first year in medical practice, when those dreams occurred, I had the feeling at the time that this was the most vivid dream I had ever had in my life. I get this over and over from people. People learn how to separate these dreams from others. Now, another clue about which ones to pay attention to are whether or not they're recurrent. If you have the same dream about something that's going to happen night after night, it just won't leave you alone. It's clamoring for attention. You ought to listen up and pay attention to that. There's one example in the book of a woman who, for a solid year, had the same dream over and over, in which a nurse came to her in the dream and shined a light on her lower leg. In the dream, it was always at the same point. She didn't have a clue about what this meant until a year later, she erupted in a focus of bone infection at that very spot, so-called osteomyelitis, which required surgery. So, you know, this took a year to unfold. It was a recurrent dream. And sometimes you just have to sit with this, as you were saying in your introduction, and be with it and let its meaning unfold as things go along. So the vividness and the recurrent nature are two clues. Another clue is that if a dream tends to be shared between you and your husband or wife or lover or whoever, if you have the dream and then your spouse begins to report having the same dream without your cluing him or her about your dream, boy, that mutual dream ought to be a clue that you ought to listen up. In the book, I'd give an example of a man who worked security at one of the trade centers, and he had a dream that the buildings were falling, bodies were falling out of the buildings, the world had turned to chaos, and his wife reported that she started having the same dream without him saying a word to her about this. They both were very intellectual people and said, you know, it's just a dream. It's one of those funny coincidences that we both had it. And they ignored it, and unfortunately, he died in the World Trade Center on 9/11. So, vividness, recurrent nature, and whether or not these things are shared are a couple of, or three clues about which to pay attention to. And another one, and then I'll quit, is whether or not...
No, I love hearing things. I love
if they
involve, I love hearing the example.
Death, if you dream about death, take it seriously. Jung said, always take dreams or intuitions or waking visions of death seriously, because you might not have a second chance. So those are four clues that people can use about, I think, how to judge these things and whether or not to pay attention to them.
It's interesting you talk about the World Trade Center. I said at the beginning of the program, I had similar with, and I was to be traveling back east and from the West Coast, and I had these premonition dreams, terror dreams. I mean, they were not even nightmares. They were like terror of me being blown up out of a plane and sucked out of. So I changed my plans, and a lot of my friends thought it was stress. And I said, no, I don't think so, and I like flying. I don't have fear of flying, but I do right now, so I'm just going to wait a little bit. And but you're right.
Prior to 9/11, did you have those dreams?
Pardon me?
You had those dreams prior to 9/11?
Prior, yes. And I was to be traveling at that from the 10th through the 15th.
Oh, my
So
God.
Right in the middle of that, yeah.
You know, if you Google premonitions of 9/11, you get hundreds of thousands of hits.
Tapped into that?
Oh, absolutely. I'll give you some statistics that people might find interesting. I think Americans have some misconceptions about those four doomed planes on 9/11. a lot of people think that there were four full planes that crashed. That just wasn't true. The planes were 80% vacant.
They were only
20% full. The range was 75% vacant to about 85% vacant. But this was true for all four planes, just not one of them. So a lot of people found some reason, apparently, not to travel that day.
It's very interesting.
I don't know about you, but I don't get on airplanes often that are, you know, only 80% vacant.
I wish. Usually they're over capacity, right?
I know it. They're asking people to change their plans to give up their seat. But not that day. So for some reason, those planes were, you know, three-quarters empty. It raises the question that whether or not people do intuit unconsciously impending disasters and choose to change their plans. I happen to believe that that is the case, and in the book I go into some scientific studies to support that idea.
Now, would you say, Dr. Dossi, so some could be conscious of this, right, or some may not be fully conscious or from a surface mind level or local mind level. They may not know why they're making these changes, but maybe they're just picking something up.
Definitely. I think most of this is not conscious.
Okay, definitely.
There's one study in which people, the researcher looked not at crashing airplanes, but this was a study looking at train wrecks and looking at the vacancy rates on the days of the train crash. And in 28 train wrecks, invariably, there was no exception to this, there was a statistically lower ridership passenger rate on the day of the crash than compared to other days for a full month in front of that. So that's one study where that was done really well. And if you interview people who change their travel plans on the day of the wreck or the crash, almost never do they have a dream or a premonition or a waking vision that a plane's going to crash or a train wreck is going to happen. One woman said that, you know, she woke up that day and she just knew that she couldn't travel. She didn't envision a plane crash. She just knew that it was not right for her to travel that day. One woman said that she had a profound feeling of malaise that day. She just felt awful. And so she knew that, you know, she would have to change her travel plans. This is unconscious stuff. It's not literal. It's more symbolic. People don't see the plane going down in flames or anything like that, generally speaking. There are some exceptions to that. But it does come out of the unconscious. It's fuzzy. It's ambiguous. It's not literal, usually, or realistic, but it can be very profound. And the point is, Michelle, that it can save people's lives if they act on it.
So just really listening. And again, what I'm getting from you, it's somehow it's being able to get clear or take that time to listen, to take that message in, whether it's through a feeling or, you know, a sign or flash of insight.
You know, you and I keep coming back to this general concept of opening up and being open and setting the stage and getting clear. I think the best way to do that is to adopt a practice of meditation in one's life, where where you develop the capacity to just simply be a good noticer, to listen, to pay attention to what comes up out of those psychic depths. Otherwise, what happens? What happens is that our minds are just swamped by all of the noise and the information and the confusion that we're all barraged with 24/7 these days. So it's really important to have some sort of practice or discipline in one's life where you learn to sit down, shut up, and tune in.
Exactly. I like how you put it, though. Be a good noticer. That's very user-friendly. It's not connotative of any theology, religion, you know, belief system. But if people could just tap into that and, like you said, develop a way, you know, to remove the distractions and just to really notice, to pay attention, you know.
Well, that's it. You know, that's one thing that all forms of contemplation have in common, whether one calls them prayer or contemplation or meditation. It's just simply to sit down and pay attention. That's whatever other benefits meditation may have, and there are many. That's certainly one of the most important, simply to cease being a victim of all of the incoming noise that we're subjected to every day of our life. Mm-hmm. And when we do that, premonitions tend to become more accurate. They become also more frequent. So it's just, you know, developing the ability to flex our psychic muscles, so to speak, just become good noticers.
So you're saying the more that one can be a good noticer or tune in or get into that state, that actually, in a sense, opens that door for more of these types of experiences.
Yes, exactly. I hear people all the time say, well, you know, I just don't have premonitions, or I never have a precognitive dream. I don't have waking visions or intuitions and so on. I tend to not believe that. I think probably most people's minds are so confused that they simply don't notice. They haven't developed that skill. Another way of inviting premonitions into one's life is pretty simple and old-fashioned. It's keeping a dream diary or a dream journal where you simply immediately on waking record your dream experience before it gets away from you. I think a lot of people who say they don't have premonitions during their dream life simply don't remember them, or they allow them to be crowded out. Keeping a dream diary not only helps you remember your dreams, it also, people say, makes them much more frequent. So I think it's just another interesting technique about how to learn to pay attention to what's going on in your psychological life. I've tried keeping a dream journal myself, and I can tell you, my dreams just went wild when I began to do that. It became much more frequent and colorful and dramatic and complex. Actually, I stopped keeping the dream journal because I was being late for work and recording these things. So I can tell you, that was a hugely interesting thing to do, and I really recommend that as a way of inviting premonitions into one's life.
Okay, that's a good tip. Got another caller here in the 814-609. You're on Awakenings.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I've been on hold for a while.
Hi.
I hear you talking a lot about 9/11 and premonitions and things of that nature. I've got a two-part question.
Okay, could we have your name first, please?
Sure. This is Eric. I'm calling from Altoona, Pennsylvania.
Oh, hey, Kirk. Hi. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. Real quick, 9/11 and all that, I understand all that, but couldn't you guys give me the fucking score of the Super Bowl? You know, I mean, wouldn't that be a lot more useful than a fucking building falling? Telling me the score of the playoff games would be much more useful right now than 9/11. So if we've got these premonitions, give me something that I can use. Who's going to win the Cubs game tonight, asshole?
Oh, Kurt. You are Kurt. Actually, I did have premonition on the lottery. So I did have those numbers at one point and did win a little bit on that. Not the big enchilada, but on something. So,
well, let me just approach that question. I get this question all the time from skeptics who say, well, if this stuff is so hot, why don't people win the lottery?
Right.
The short answer is that sometimes they do. So it's not true. It is not true that people do not have premonitions where monetary rewards are concerned. I have a whole section in my book on using premonitions to make money in the silver futures market. This isn't the Super Bowl, but it's very similar because money and payoffs are involved. So there have been several control studies looking at the ability of people to use their premonition instincts to make money. So I would just, was it Eric? I think that from Altoona. If you're interested, chase down the studies and just simply look at the data yourself.
There you go.
So there is data along these lines. I happen to have one instance or example on file in my archives in this area from a woman in upstate New York who got into trouble with personal debts, and so she actually prayed to have a vision or a dream of the winning lottery numbers for a particular type of lottery in New York State. She actually saw the winning numbers in her dream, entered them, and won just enough to liquidate all of her personal debts. She did this not once, in which case you might just say, well, that was just a lucky hit or a coincidence. She did it twice. A few years later, her roof began to leak, and she needed to replace it, and it was very expensive. So she asked to see the winning lottery numbers again, and she did see them in her dream, entered them, and won just enough once again to replace her roof. It's simply not true that people never have premonitions or foreknowledge that rewards them with money. It does happen. I would particularly recommend that anybody who doesn't believe this go to the book and look up the studies looking at the use of premonition in the silver futures market. They're done extraordinarily respectably with respect to scientific methodology. So simply check it out for yourself.
Well, and that's the thing. You have the the research behind it. I know, and from personally and anecdotally, I have seen that play out, whether people are even doing it by the intention or just getting some numbers in a dream, or I've even seen it with the the horse races. that it's happened. What do you think? And I do see we have another caller. We'll get right to you, caller number two. But Dr. Doss, I wanted to ask you, why would you think that woman was able to do it in a succession of times?
Well, I think
is it her intention?
I think intention did play a role. I mean, she had a need. She asked. She was specific, and she got her request granted. There's an interesting aspect to these studies where people try to make money in this way. In the silver futures studies, the thing that comes to the surface in almost every one of these studies is whether or not greed enters in. As long as people keep their request or their wishes fairly modest, it seems to work. And it certainly did in this woman's experience that I mentioned. She had a specific need. She didn't try to break the bank and win the big one. The first occasion, she wanted just enough to liquidate her debts. She got it. The second time, she put a limit on it. She just wanted to replace the roof. She wanted the amount to do that. In the silver futures premonition studies, you see the same thing. In one study, the goal was to win enough to finance some research in this area, and the studies worked beautifully. Overwhelmingly, as a matter of fact. In another instance, the people wanted to win just enough to start a new Waldorf school in their community. They won that amount. But then when they went back and repeated the studies and tried to go for broke and tried to simply get rich, the studies fell flat. It was almost as if greed poisoned the results of these things. So I think that there's a lesson there. Greed seems to be toxic to this sort of thing, but as long as wishes and wants and requests are limited to specific needs, if they're, as we say, need-oriented and not greed-oriented, the success rate in these things, as far as the controlled studies are concerned, are very high.
That's great. That's kind of makes sense, too, because you're kind of putting it on a lower level with the greed factor, you know. We do have a question from Kathy in the chat room. Her question is basically coming from the medical background. Have you had medical premonitions, and or most of your premonitions medical, or are they all types of premonitions?
Well, most of the ones that I deal with as a physician are medically oriented, but maybe it's just because I'm more tuned into those sorts of things. But I think there's a deeper reason that most of these things are health-oriented, by which I mean they warn people of upcoming threats to their health. They warn them of diseases that are in early stages and so on. I think premonitions are survival-oriented. What I mean by that is that in our evolutionary history as the human species, I suspect that people developed this ability because it helped them stay alive. By warning them of threats to their health, of where predators were and how to avoid them if they knew about them ahead of time and so on. So I think it makes good biological sense that most of these things are oriented towards health and survival. There are a ton of instances in the book about this survival, health-oriented aspect of premonitions. In my own experience, people used to come to me with their intuitions, their dreams about illnesses that actually played out. One morning I was in my office and a woman came, knocked on my door. She was a brilliant attorney woman, and she had had a dream the night before in which she said she saw three little white spots on her left ovary, and she was convinced she had ovarian cancer, and she was scared to death. Her exam was normal. We did a sonogram to get a picture of her ovaries, and sure enough, on her left ovary, she had those three little spots just as she had dreamed. Fortunately, she got her diagnosis wrong. They were benign ovarian cysts and not ovarian cancer. But she had a perfectly accurate visual dream about these things, and she did the right thing. She didn't waste any time getting them checked out. I recently was talking about this book in a bookstore in Seattle, and after my talk, a woman came up and told me a story in which she had a dream one night where she specifically saw a tiny area in one of her breasts where there was breast cancer. She went to the doctor and said, "This is where I've got breast cancer, so we need to take care of this." She could not feel a lump, neither could the doctor, and the mammogram was normal. So the doctor tried to reassure her, and she said, "No, it's there. This was the most vivid dream I've ever had in my life. We've got to go further." This doctor sort of bullied a surgeon friend of his to do a biopsy right at the point where she pointed with one finger in her breast. And a few days later, the pathology report came back, and the pathologist phoned the original doctor and said, "How did you discover this? This is microscopic. There would be no lump there. This is the tiniest breast cancer I've ever seen." And the doctor honestly said, "I didn't discover it. She did in a dream."
He told you.
And so, I mean, the specificity of some of these things is just astonishing. And that's just an example of how these things are often health-related, pointing toward a problem at a very early stage before it's well-developed.
And that they follow through. That is amazing. Yeah. That's to trust, because it's one thing to receive the information or the insight, but then also to know. And part of what I keep hearing you say also, Dr. Dossie, is that the vividness, there's something that kind of wakes them up or says, pay attention, because it's so vivid.
Well, it grabs hold of people often and just will not let them go. You know, you try to ignore it, but you can't do that. And often the dream is recurrent, as if it's, you know, banging on the doors of consciousness for admission into your waking life. And so people say they can't get away from these things often. You know, these premonition-type awarenesses have a tenacity all their own, and they just often will not let you go.
Keep at you. We have another question in the chat, Dr. Dossie. If you had any experience with the Edgar Cayce Institute, she's saying this reminds her of that.
Well, sure. I mean, Cayce was one of the great dreamers of the 20th century, and I did not go into the Cayce work in my book. The reason was that the book was sprawling anyway, and I just simply had to put some limits on it. But Casey certainly is, Edgar Casey is certainly one of the great precognitive dreamers where health is concerned, and certainly he fits into this overall landscape.
Mm-hmm.
But I just made a conscious choice to, put the stops on the book because half of it wound up being edited out anyway.
You could go on and on.
It was. The manuscript was just enormous, and I just couldn't fit everything into it.
Well, you're prolific in your writings. I mean, look how many books you have out and, articles and studies. And it's, a lot of wonderful information. You'll just have to do you'll have to do part two of Premonitions.
It's in the works.
In the works already.
Okay,
we have another.
Actually, this book has resulted in so many stories that people have sent me via email and told me in person on book tour that I really do have a lot of material, and so I'm really contemplating a sequel to this particular book.
Well, it would be well welcomed. We have someone calling in via Skype, I believe. You're on line two. Did you have a question or comment for Dr. Dossey?
Yes, I do have both. Hi, Michelle. Hi, Dr. Dossey.
Hi.
My name is Michelle. I'm calling from Florida.
Hi.
I've been having this, reoccurring dreams about, being operated on. But it's usually, sometimes I get this pain in my lower abdomen, and after I dream about being operated, it goes away, and I'll go to the doctor, and they can't find anything. Then the second dream is about being operated on my left side of the brain. But after the operation is done, I'm able to, hear stuff clearly from, I don't know. It's hard to explain. It's just hear stuff and just get these, if I'm in a crowd, automatically I get this, sensation that's, telling me, get away from here, get away from here.
Mm-hmm.
And usually starts, with dreams. And second question is, what is the difference between, dreams, premonitions, and, I guess sensation, when you feel something, your inner gut or something.
Yeah, well,
is it all tied into one, and how to stop it, or how to just, if you're not interested in that type of, environment, I guess.
Well, for one thing, I don't think there's a great division between what I'm calling premonitions and what other people call intuition or vibes or gut feelings, and so on. I think there's just a huge mix of these things, and it's wrong to try to, put them in boxes and separate them. I think they're all related. I've mentioned dreams, premonitions in the form of dreams a lot, but these things occur in waking visions and waking hunches as well. For one thing, dreams, premonitions can be either literal, real, or they can be symbolic. They can be metaphorical. And it's very difficult sometimes to know which is which. For example, in your dreams of an operation, when people hear that term operation, they may think surgery, but an operation may be something else. It may be the need to rearrange something, to operate on it and transform it into something else. So the fact that you may have a dream of a surgical procedure may be a symbol for something else. But sometimes it's not clear, of course, whether a dream is symbolic or literal. And as Michelle and I were talking earlier, sometimes you simply have to be with these things and live with them, and over time permit the dream to sort itself out in terms of whether it's literal or whether it's symbolic. And that may take a while. You went to the doctor with this dream of something going on in your abdomen. Nobody could find anything. And that's the first step. And I think you acted responsibly about that. Past that point, I think you just simply have to sometimes be patient and let things unfold and take an invitational stance and ask the premonition to reveal itself to you and declare what it really means. So it sometimes takes a lot of patience, and sometimes we don't have that, but we need to develop it, because sometimes you cannot manipulate these things on your own terms, but you simply have to live and be with them and as they say, live into the answer sometimes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
Wonderfully put, Dr. Dossi. That I love what you're saying because you're, well, number one, you're telling people the truth. That you're going to have to maybe sit with it a little bit, be receptive. It could be a few, you know, meanings there, right? There could be a few meanings that are coming through for an individual.
Absolutely. Meanings, you know, meanings can be frustrating. They don't always reveal themselves, their true nature, immediately. We always want mm-hmm. that, don't we? We want the mm-hmm. answer now. Sometimes the answer doesn't come in that form, though. It requires patience.
And, you know, that's a really good point. What do you suggest for people? Because what I have found is, again, a lot of times people get their expectations in the way, and I'm not whether they're good or negative expectations or small or big or whatever, but I find that that can block. What can people do? Because a lot of times meanings will come through, and they're like, oh, it must mean this.
Well,
you know, I can't tell you how many people, like, let's say getting married. Oh,
yeah.
I got married in my dream. That means I'm meeting my soulmate. You know, it's like, right?
I just must confess an inherent skepticism toward applying any sort of formula. You and I were talking about this a moment ago. As just a single example, there are dream interpretation books out there where you can – you know, just go through the index, look up your dream, and go to page 241 and just find out what that dream means.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really hazardous. That's living by mm-hmm. the formula. It's denying the uniqueness of every human being. There are no two of us who are alike. It may be that there are no two dreams that actually mean the same thing. I just think when we get into this demanding mode where we want to know now, literally, how to decode dreams, premonitions, hunches, visions, and so on, we really have to be careful. The tendency is to want an answer now. We want a specific – that's what creates the market for these types of books, these mm-hmm. formulaic books, which I think really can be very deceptive. They give mm-hmm. people false assurance. You tend to there's a tendency, if you believe the literal interpretation of a dream according to a dream book, you live into the dream book, and you don't live according to your own wisdom. You substitute somebody's formula for the uniqueness of your and richness of your own experience. I think that that's really foolish, myself. And I, you know, it's not comforting for people like myself to tell others, be patient. Stay with it, be open, don't force it, and so on. It's our human nature to want to do something and get the answer right now. But mm-hmm. life isn't always like that. And sometimes we have
to... No, and you people, you're giving them the truth, though, that maybe many books later they would have to get. Because, you see... At some point, everybody arrives at the same place and goes, I really guess I have to look within. I have to take the time. I have to do the inner work. I have to see what this means for me. We all end up there. Some of us end up there a little sooner, some a little later. Right?
Well, I know. You know, we all want shortcuts. And the
me too.
And sometimes that just, you know, leads us into a labyrinth where painfully later we find that we really do need to develop a tolerance for ambiguity and fuzziness in our life and be open to mystery.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a huge fan of mystery. And a mystery is an exercise in not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way the unconscious works, you know. It doesn't dance to our tune. And sometimes sitting with the mystery is the best way to go.
And how can, if let's say people following their premonitions or knowing what they're receiving, what ways do you find that that shapes one's life?
Well, if you take the health-related dreams seriously, it can help you have a life.
Right.
Right? I mean, it can shape your future to the extent of helping you have a future. Because a lot of these things, as we've already said, are survival-oriented. They can help you avoid things that are threats to your health and that might even shorten your life. So the health-oriented dreams are fairly easy, you know. As Jung said, if they deal with death, take it seriously because you may not get a second chance. But on the other hand, a lot of premonitions don't deal with survival issues. They have to do with complex issues in our life. And I think that all premonitions that turn out to be true are just a huge gift because they tell us something important about ourselves, about how we how we exist in the world. As you and I first started out this conversation, we were talking about non-local mind. Premonitions point like an arrow to some sort of quality of our consciousness that's infinite in space and time, that's immortal, that's eternal. This is the greatest gift a premonition can give anybody, the assurance that with the death of the physical body, that's not the end of it. There's something else, and that something else is what premonitions point to, some aspect of who we are that's divine to the extent of being immortal and eternal and omnipresent. So that's the great gift premonitions serve. Whatever else they may convey to us in terms of health issues and so on, that's the greatest gift that they can possibly give us, in my judgment.
Mm-hmm. So in a sense, you're saying this, it's a doorway or a channel or a way to tap into that realm.
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah, that's a good way to look at it. Got another couple calls here. 323-571, you're on Awakenings with Dr. Larry Dossey.
Yes, my name is Ryel Sims, and I'm calling from Los Angeles, California. And
welcome.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment. I don't know if you mentioned just having thoughts of someone and having thoughts of someone and that person calls you or that person comes by. And is that something that you can be conscious of in the future or condition your brain to know that when you think of someone, that at that time that you think of someone that you, sorry, if you think of someone that you could write it down and know that that person is going to call me today because when people say, when someone gets a telephone call and they go, hey, I was just thinking about you. And if we can condition our brain that when we, the minute we think about someone, if we can write that down and to know that that person is going to call us or contact us in some kind of way, are we able to do that?
Yes, there's a book out that I would recommend, written by a very dear friend of mine, Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, who is a Cambridge-trained biologist who is in England. It's called The Sense of Being Stared At. And this book deals with precisely the phenomena you're talking about. There are actually studies of people who predict when someone's going to call them, and it happens. And the ability of people to do this is just not a random thing. This is far greater than chance happenings. Statistically, it's very solid. So if you want to look at this, I'd really recommend that book to you, The Sense of Being Stared At by Dr. Sheldrake. I think you would like the data that's presented in there in the various studies. Actually, Dr. Sheldrake looked at the manuscript of my book on premonitions before it was published, and he and I are very much attuned about the nature of consciousness in terms of it being non-local or infinite in space and time. So what I'm talking about in terms of consciousness being able to operate outside the present, forwards and backwards in time, is very much what you're attuned to here and what you're asking. Your ability to predict and possibly make happen events into the future. So I think we're on the same page here, and I'd give a yes answer to your questions.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And actually, you can, like just with setting up the dreams like you were talking about earlier, Dr. Dossey, you can encode yourself that your mind or brain starts acting in that way, that you start thinking in that in that way so that you set up. It's like updating your inner software, if you will, to that now I put the call. I do this actually quite a bit. I'll beam, I call it beaming people. I'll think of someone or something that I want. And as Dr. Dossie was saying earlier, I get a receptive state. And I just put the vision and the feeling tone of that person or that situation or that we've connected. And sometimes it's seconds, sometimes it's minutes, but it's never longer than a day or two that would draw that in. Or they say, I was just calling you or thinking about you or, you know. So, yeah, you can definitely program your mind that you have those experiences consistently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think this should be considered very mysterious because what we're talking about here is the power of suggestion. Conventional psychology accepts the fact that that suggestion is very real. And what we're doing, we're just taking the power of suggestion and the power of knowing outside the individual brain and body and outside of the present and extending it forward into time and out into space. That's what non-local mind permits us to do.
And I was just going to ask you that. Isn't that, in essence, what you were speaking about in your book, Recovering the Soul, Rupert Sheldrake calls it the morphogenic field, the non-local mind. Aren't you saying, in a sense, when people are doing that or programming for that, they're becoming aware of that or aligning to that?
Exactly. That's just part of their human endowment. The fact is,
okay,
this is just the way we work. This is nothing, you know, woo-woo or, you know, California crazy or, you know, all those pejorative terms that people use sometimes to describe this. This is simply part of who we are as human beings. Dr. Sheldrake's favorite term for this ability is extended mind. I like the term non-local mind. It's the same thing. It's our minds operating as they're geared to do, outside the present moment and outside the here and now.
Great. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you. I mean, you're welcome.
Yeah, thank you, too. Okay. Another quick call, and then we got just 2 minutes, 212-343. You're on Awakening.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have two things that sort of run by you. I'm not sure if they're premonitions or not. I moved to New York City in 1999. In August of 2001, I was on my way to work in downtown Manhattan, knowing that I was going to go to North Carolina for the weekend to see my family. And the thought popped into my head, God, wouldn't it be awful if I had to make my way around the city on crutches? Well, sure enough, that weekend, I went and visited my family. We're getting ready to play some football. I specifically was even stretching because I was just like, I don't know, just like thinking this thing. Next thing you know, we're playing football. Boom. I pop a tendon in my foot. And I go back to North Carolina. I go back to New York in a cast. And here's the interesting thing. Several weeks later, I was caught in 9/11 right near the South Tower. And I twice in 45 minutes crutched for my life on my crutches. And it was only after all that I thought, first of all, when I tore my ankle tendon, I thought, oh my God, I know I specifically had this thought worrying about it, and there it happened. And then just a few weeks after that, I'm crutching for my life twice in 45 minutes, first when the second plane hit and I was near the South Tower and didn't know what the explosion was, and then I got out of the way, and when the South Tower collapsed, all the smoke came at me and I crutched again. Would you consider that a sort of premonition, or is it just a weird confluence of things?
Well, that's the eternal argument about premonitions. Are these things just coincidences and accidental happenings, or is something else going on in the way of a premonition of actually sensing information into the future? It's up for you to decide. In my judgment, I can't make that decision for you, but what I can tell you is that there were an awful lot of people who have premonitions and dreams of 9/11, and if you Google dreams of 9/11, you come up with 14 million hits.
Wow.
If you try to if narrow it down and just go for premonitions of 9/11, you reduce it to something like 500 or 600,000. You're in a great, a huge group of individuals who had information that turned out to be accurate about those future events. Now, I think that, you know, this wasn't a control study. You can't do that kind of study in advance because you didn't know when, no researcher knew that 9/11 was going to actually happen that day. But you have to do retrospective studies with something like this and be open to the possibility that this huge outpouring of premonition was or was not a an indicator of something to come. I happen to think that the control studies, which we haven't gone into in this discussion, give a yes answer to whether or not people could accurately anticipate 9/11. Most people did it symbolically. Something was going on. Something was wrong. Something was out of whack. And for that reason, a lot of people canceled or changed their plans about travel that day and so on. I go into a lot of those examples in the book. Those are just people's stories, however. However, if you combine the stories and the anecdotes with control studies, computer-based studies about people's ability to sense what's coming up next on a randomized computer program, and the answers turn out to be positive, if you combine those scientific findings with people's actual experiences such as yours, I think you've really got something there. And what you've got is evidence for the ability of people to know what's coming up. They may not know it literally, but they can know it symbolically. And I believe this is where the stories turn into solid science.
Right.
It sounds like you're premonition prone. I mean,
well, I have one more if there's a minute. I've never shared this with anybody before, but if you're late, I understand.
A minute, because we're really winding down, but a minute.
Okay.
If it's really a minute, okay.
There's a friend in my community. I don't live in Manhattan now. I live out suburban New Jersey. She's a woman. She's got married and had two kids. And driving down the road in my car, I saw her. And this thought just popped into my mind, like, what if she was widowed and I was widowed? Strange, right? Would we get together? 2 months later, her husband, somebody who I know, died while jogging, had a heart attack. And, you know, I've never said this. I never told anybody about this because it was, I was immediately like, oh, my God, I had this, like, weird thing about her being a widow and me being a widower, too, and getting together. And there, you know, there it is within two months. It was, like, this thing that happened. It's like,
wow.
Well, sounds like you're dialed in. Sounds like you're very dialed in, to say the least, right?
Yes,
yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Thank
anyway,
you
I guess I better get your book.
Thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks for sharing. And, yes, The Power of Premonition.
Right. Thanks.
All righty. Thank you. And just real briefly, we had one last question about the power, I think we touched on this, but the idea of the non-local mind. We had a question in the chat. How would you describe that, Dr. Dossie? Hello?
I think one has to just simply resort to how it operates in people's lives. That's the best definition I think one can give. It's simply the ability of ourselves to insert information into the environment at a distance and outside of the present. For example, through healing thoughts and imagery, visualization, prayer, contemplation, and so on, in order to effect what's going on in the world through healing and so on. I've devoted books to exploring that aspect. But there's another aspect that this book deals with about premonition. That's where we don't insert information in the world to make something happen. We acquire information from the world. We receive information from the world and use that to make a difference in our own lives and the lives of other people. So the two aspects, this non-local mind, inserting information out there into the world to make something happen, and also receiving information to make a difference in our lives and the lives of other people.
Wonderfully put. Thank you so much, Dr. Dossie, for being with us.
Just great audience, and you've got a great program and a great listenership.
Thank you. Well, they're all click in the links for the book. So those of you that are going to be listening later in the archives or via iTunes, I want to let you know you can reach Dr. Dossey for further information on his website, LarryDossey.com. And Dossey is D-O-S-S-E-Y, so LarryDossey.com.
It's www.DosseyDossey.com.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's DosseyDossey.com. Uh-huh.
Okay, so we've been putting in, I think, the other link. Does the other link lead there too, though? DosseyDossey.com. Okay, good that you know that. I put that in the chat. So www.DosseyDossey.com. The book that we have been speaking about is The Power of Premonition, How Knowing the Future Can Shape Our Lives. So thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in and making Awakenings what it is. Until next time, continue to shine your light, share your insight, and keep awake.